Who says that fiction's only in false hair become a verse? Is there in truth no beauty? Is all good structure in a winding stair? May no lines pass except they do their duty, not to a true, but painted chair? Hello, and thanks very much for downloading the latest edition of Whom Pods Destroy. I'm Terry DeFellin. If you are a new listener, then welcome. This podcast focuses on the original series of Star Trek, and it's presented by me, and I'm joined by Graham Sibley and Derek Mantle. In this edition, we discuss the third season episode, Is There in Truth No Beauty? Given the age of this episode and the fact that you are here, we assume that you've already seen it. However, if you haven't, or haven't in a while, then you may want to give it a watch, as we'll be revealing spoilers. This episode carries on nicely from our previous episode, in which we discussed Return to Tomorrow, which shares the same guest star, music composer, and director. If you haven't heard that episode, then, well, don't worry, it's not essential. But it is available to hear from our website, whompodsdestroy.com. There you will also find links to our social channels, email address, and of course the feeds for you to subscribe. Feeds. If you have any feedback, then we encourage you to get in touch on Twitter or by email. We'll be very happy to read out any messages from listeners.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
I don't care how benevolent the Medusans are supposed to be. Isn't it suicidal to deal with something ugly enough to drive man mad? Why do you do it?
I see, Dr. McCoy, that you still subscribe to the outmoded notion promulgated by your ancient Greeks that what is good must also be beautiful.
And the reverse, of course, that what is beautiful is automatically expected to be good.
Yes, I think most of us are attracted by beauty and repelled by ugliness, one of the last of our prejudices. At the risk of sounding prejudiced, gentlemen, here's to beauty. To Miranda Jones, the loveliest human ever to grace a starship.
How can one so beautiful condemn herself to look upon ugliness the rest of her life?
Will we allow it, gentlemen?
Certainly not.
Thank you.
How can one so full of joy and the love of life as you, Doctor, condemn yourself to look upon disease and suffering for the rest of your life? Can we allow that, gentlemen?
To whatever you want the most, Miranda.
Some more Antarian brandy. What is it?
There's somebody nearby thinking of murder.
Hello, and welcome back for another episode of Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry DeFellin, and I'm joined, as always, by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And Derek Mantle.
Hello.
How are we doing, chaps?
We're good.
It seems like ages since we were last talking.
It does, doesn't it?
Seems like ages, but it's not.
It's not. Just what, really 5 minutes,
isn't.
I think.
Yeah, we haven't actually stopped talking.
No.
All we've really done is just turn the microphone back on.
Yes, that's what we do.
We're going to talk about another episode of Star Trek, because that's what we're here for. And we're going to talk about an episode from the third season, which is called Is There in Truth No Beauty? Which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's a line from a poem by George Herbert.
Herbert.
From the 17th century. It's different in its meaning to, I think, what the theme of this episode is actually more about. Interestingly, but we can save that for our poetry podcast, which we'll do at some point in
there is a bit more poetry mentioned in here.
There's Byron, yeah. And then there's, of course, there's Shakespeare as well.
In the far future, in an alternative reality.
What, us or...
Yes.
Yeah, fine.
Mirror Us, we'll be talking about that
poetry.
Right now,
yes, yeah, Mirror, where we'll be donning our goatees and discussing poetry, yeah. As we do, and how it serves the Empire. Long live the Empire. The themes of this story are notions of beauty and notions of ugliness, and ugliness within and beauty without, and beauty within and ugliness without. And in short, what it is that Miranda Jones who is consumed by her jealousy and her perhaps unrequited love for Carlos, is ugly on the inside and yet beautiful on the outside, whereas Carlos, who is so ugly that he can barely be regarded without going mad, is in fact a very, very lovely person. And there's this wonderful scene on the bridge where Spock and Carlos join, and we see just what a lovely guy Carlos is. Very friendly, very charming, and again, it's more opportunities for Spock to emote and do the things that he's very, very good at doing. So, gents, there's an awful lot going on in this episode,
isn't
there?
It's a brilliant episode.
It is a brilliant episode.
It is a cracking, cracking episode, this yes. one. This is, I think, the best one of the third season.
Really?
It is. It is. I think it is that good. And it's good for reasons that are not particularly Trek. I mean, I think a lot of people like this because it covers a lot of Trek ideas, the IDIC and things like that, which is, you can argue one way or the other about its inclusion in this episode because this is something that Gene Roddenberry shoehorned in for merchandise sales. But the concept of it, merchandise or not, is something that's really, really Star Trek, and it's really, really one of the firm bases of
and it fits, and it fits perfectly with this.
And it fits perfectly what we've got here. But the way that this episode's put together is really, really interesting, and it's really different. And it only struck me late last night when I was thinking about what I'm preparing for today, and I thought, I know why I like this episode so much. This is more like a Doctor Who episode than a Star Trek episode. And
really?
And I think it was only just realised that the fact of like the Medusan and about the concept of him living in this box of being something so ugly. And I think it's because it's so cheap. It's they make so many. It's a bottle episode.
It is a bottle episode, yeah.
And it's entirely made on a budget. But whereas most of the third season seems to be fighting against all the constraints that the third season puts up with budgets and all the writers and everything like that, this one actually works with it. This is actually goes with it and says, right, okay, well, we'll actually create an episode. We're not going to try and paddle against this. We're just going to go with it. And it works really well. And they try some really avant-garde stuff.
Yeah.
With the direction and the music. And it works.
Well,
it works for me. And I can see a lot of Star Trek fans would watch this and think, no, this is really different, and it's different in a way that I don't like, but I love it.
I totally go, you know, completely with you, and I love the idea about it being a bit more like a Doctor Who episode. I love it because the whole thing does look very different. The music's different.
Mm.
Funny enough, it's the same.
It's the same guy. Composer. Same guy as we did last week.
Yeah.
George Dooney. Yeah.
And also, it's the same director.
And it's the same director. Yeah. Ralph Senesky. Yeah.
But it looks completely different. I had to just check on the director on this because what I found that I really loved about it was the colours are great.
Yeah.
The music's great. The angles of the photography are completely different from. I mean, I'm not even. Yeah. I'm not talking about the bits when
the more obvious ones.
The like, more like obvious ones.
The fisheye lens.
Fish eye. But there's lots of long shots. As well, which you don't usually get. And there's this great bit when Kirk is striding down the hallway with his security guards behind him, and they're not saying anything.
Mm.
And that's just really powerful. And you don't see that in Star Trek.
It's only for you, because I remember that as well, because he's walking there, and he's then and he's exuding power.
That's but it.
He's
exactly.
He's not running. He's just not rushed. Yeah. He's got his crew behind him, and he's going to go there and find out what on earth is.
And the camera angles are really interesting because I was just wondering, because this is a little bit, because it's in the 60s. I mean, this is nearly 50 years ago. But one of my favourite films is The Ipcress File. And, you know,
I believe that may have been referred to on this podcast more than once, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. Because the thing I'm sure I did, but the thing that reminded me was those angles.
Mm.
And it seemed to be like Sidney Furey, who was a Canadian director who directed The Ipcress File. And he did, a lot of his films were a bit like that. He tried to sort of experiment. The first thing I thought when I first saw it was, okay, it's a 60s psychedelic film.
Yeah.
But it's not.
No.
But it's not, because that's the thing, is these angles, it's nothing to do with psychedelic effects.
No.
The only psychedelic effect you have is actually with the Medusa alien. Also, the other thing is, it's a proper alien. It's not like someone dressed up in the
same. No, no, like, it's truly alien. Yeah,
a concept which we haven't seen very often in Star Trek, because usually, you know, budgets and everything, you stick a couple of things on someone's head.
And yeah, and this isn't a bloke underneath the doormat, no. Is it? It is something.
No, although, I mean, let's not. I mean, the Hawtra are great.
The Hawtra are great.
I mean, as aliens, Star Trek aliens go, the Hawtra are among the best because they're, again, proper alien. Yes. Silicon-based life. But yeah, no, the concept. So much of subsequent Star Trek and previous has always been aliens have been human beings with prosthetics.
Yes.
Whereas, and this I think has allowed them to be a little bit lazy, I think, in pursuing genuine alien creatures. And Kolos, the Medusan, is a genuinely alien creature. Just on the angles thing, there's an angle from when Larry is in the bridge causing trouble. They're up on the bridge. There's an angle from inside the turbo lift. Looking out onto the bridge, which I don't think we've ever had or very rarely seen. Mm. That caught my eye on.
Because I noticed there's a lot of the angles from the grating in the in engineering, but also the sort of effect inside the living quarters. Lots of cameras looking through these things rather than the side.
Third season is quite a bit like that. If you watch Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, there's a lot of that going on there. There's a lot of quick cuts as well. Yeah, exactly. So I wonder whether or not this is perhaps there's been some direction from above. Maybe this is a Fred Freiberger thing, who's perhaps encouraging people to be a little bit more experimental with their
animals. I suppose really after the second series, though, the second series was limited in direction because it really just split between two directors, and it was great for getting lots of episodes out quickly and to time and to budget, but it started to fall flat and there was a formulaic approach to it. And I think this is one of the things why the third season sticks out a bit, is because they bring in new directors and new writers. And oftentimes it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Here it does. It really does.
Doesn't make it any less interesting, but yeah, here it does. A Spectre of the Gun is another one where they use their zero budget to really good effect. But this one works really well.
Yeah, the only time I can think of an earlier episode, say like a season one episode, where the direction has been so noticeable is perhaps something like Galileo 7. With the confined space inside the shuttlecraft, but that's the odd angles that we use there.
Mm. Yeah, because we've got a lot of fisheye lenses as well.
Yeah.
So you got the perspective of when you're mad.
Yeah, that's
the thing is that
shot of Kirk with his hands out like that and the crew around it as well. It's just such good cinematography.
Well, the fight in engineering.
Yeah,
with the fisheye engine with Larry, the POV shots from Larry as he's gone mad. I mean, the fisheye is great because it's a shortcut to the human brain to tell you this is madness.
Yeah,
this is wrong and strange. But it's so ridiculously straightforward. I mean, fisheye lenses are 10 a penny. I mean, like you've got them. You don't have to spend any money.
Yeah.
Clunk a fisheye on it, and you've just massively altered the perspective of the viewer right there and then for zero money.
But also, as well, the music works really well in there as well.
Oh, that electric organ's brilliant.
The scene where Larry leaves, well, between Larry leaving Jones's quarters and goes to kill Kolos, that's brilliant. That just walk down the corridor and it's like the music's really like going. And it is... Because a lot of this is psychological horror, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In here, this is what we have in this sort of early stage, and it really carries that forward. So like really sort of getting into those sort of horror films at the time, you can almost imagine that music being in some kind of like Hammer portmanteau film or something like that. It is really good.
It works really well. It's brilliant. I mean, I would just go back to the sort of sequence of direction and using different techniques to push the story on or to try and affect something different. The sequence, this is real later on, is that when Spock is in his coma, where the connection between Miranda and him when she's trying to get him out of there. There is a sort of dreamlike sequence, which is brilliant. So you're actually seeing what's actually going on in Spock's head while he's, you know, comatose, which I hadn't seen before. You know, and it's all the different cuts from different things that have already happened.
That is quite a Freiburger thing, because if you remember from Cloudminders, when he does that sort of synopsis thing, when you see the clips of the inner monologue. So I suppose that's something that he might put in there, that
works very well. I mean, as a climax to an episode in which basically it's just two people holding on to each other and there's a conflict going on in the mind, that is something that you can do really, really badly, and actually it works really, really well. I mean, it is a cerebral episode. It's not. There's not a great deal of action. There's no. I mean, there's one. There is a fist fight in there, but it's not.
Couple,
you know.
I think it's good for that, because it doesn't. Whereas I think the episode that we spoke about last week or last time out, which was Return to Tomorrow, held back a bit on the more sort of
physicality,
adult themes. It's got there. The more sort of like the consequences of this situation. This one doesn't. This one really holds on to it. Doesn't dumb it down at all. Just goes with it and says, right, okay, you've got to keep up with this.
Is this because we've got a new writer here?
Jean Lisette Aroisti is a writer. It's a spec script. A fan of the series wrote in with it, and that's what it is. So, I mean, obviously it would have been rewritten, but interestingly, at this point, Roddenberry's involvement in this show is, you know, minimal.
Okay.
He's not really around that much in the show by now. He's lost interest. He's downhearted by the fact that he got bumped in the schedule, and it looked like this was the last series. And I don't know how much of there is of Roddenberry in this. That's very interesting.
Well, there is that whole IDIC stuff. He put that in.
Yeah, of course, because that was for a merchant. That's a rather cynical attempt to sell some merchandise on his part.
And Nimoy was one who led the protest against it to temper that down.
Oh, really? He had a protest against it. He didn't want to sort of commercialise it, sort of. As
well, he was one who said, "Look, no, you don't." Yeah, basically, he said, "Look,
unless you give me a cut."
Bearing in mind that Nimoy didn't. Nimoy was owed quite a lot of money by the studio after Star Trek was made, and which he didn't get until they wanted to make the motion picture.
Really?
And it was then that was only the time when he had sufficient leverage to say, "Give me my money, you bastards, or I will not do this film."
Mm-hmm.
And then they coughed up the dough. So he obviously had a bit of a troubled relationship with people there about that. So maybe there was an element
of
that.
It didn't stop his craft, because he was very good in this.
By no means.
You know.
And the whole IDIC thing, I mean, like, this is the birth of that concept. I mean, it's interesting that this idea has come about, which is effectively a merchandising opportunity, and yet it's actually given birth to a massive sort of like plank of Star Trek lore, you know, the infinite diversity and infinite combinations, you know, the very much at the heart of how many Trekkies define Star Trek.
It's Star Trek's force, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And yet, its genesis comes from a merchandising opportunity, which, the more you learn about the behind-the-scenes things of Star Trek, the more actually you think, well, that doesn't surprise me at all. Let us talk about Miranda Jones, if we may. This is the second episode in which we've in succession where we've done an episode that has Diane Muldaur in it. She returns to Star Trek for this episode,
and she'll be back again. More startling,
and she's amazing, isn't she?
Yeah.
I mean, she's a quality actress.
Yes,
We knew that from when she was playing Anne Mulhall in Return to Tomorrow. And we know that definitely now. I think she's got a lot more to deal with, though. This character is a lot more interesting. She's the classic female character, which I think a lot of women would identify with, is that she's beautiful, she's wanted, professional, incredibly intelligent, and yet in the eyes of many of the men around her, is not complete unless she marries and has children, essentially. Yeah. And I actually think that the script writers actually handled that element of it relatively well, actually. I think she comes out of it. I mean, there are other elements, not so much. But I think that they're mindful of this stigma that I think she has. And she defends herself quite well in the dining room during the dinner.
Mm.
You know, and McCoy says, albeit fairly playfully, so like, how can we allow you to go and spend all this time on this planet with all these ugly people? And her riposte is, well, how can we allow a man who loves life as much as you to be surrounded by pain and suffering? And I think that there's a degree of awareness on the part of the producers and the scriptwriters.
Well, the amount of drool that was around that table.
That scene can be looked at as being a bit, well, you know, this is a bit 60s, isn't it? Look at them, the round the table, really just surrounding her.
Yes.
Like a pack of wolves, basically. Mm. But like
bees on honey.
But it is... I mean, I've read some reviews of this episode, which sort of say, I don't know how it makes sense. I mean, like, because they're all really, like excessively drooling over her. And there's, like, theories about, like, she's like, got casting some kind of telepathic hold over them or something like
that.
Or just, like or somehow her telepathic powers are out of control.
Or she's just a woman who's just ignoring all the men.
Yeah. But I think it's actually worked quite well, because it's like, well, actually, no. Look, what he's actually doing is actually showing them up for what they're doing.
Yeah, they are.
Even back then, they're like acting like, you know, teenage boys around.
And they're all quite pathetic, you know. I mean, obviously...
And presumptuous.
And Larry...
And of course, it gives her a chance of saying, of putting them in their place. Yes. Really. And
it's an important scene as well, because the thing is that it leads up to where Larry leaves as well, when he... You can see that he's obviously got his big thing for Miranda, you know, because he's a little bit outraged that they're all drooling over her and that they're actually not giving her respect. Because he actually does say that. He does say that you should show some respect to her. Mm. And then he rushes off after her.
Yeah. You know? He's got it bad.
Yeah,
for
because
him,
he's know? Completely been friend-zoned, doesn't
he? Yeah. He has indeed been friend-zoned. Yeah. Poor Larry.
Yeah.
Diana Muldaur, the way that she plays it, because we don't obviously know that she's blind until about roughly halfway through or towards the end of the, you know, and I mean, one thing I noticed about her is that it's been such a long time, so I can't really fully remember how surprised I was when I found out that she was blind, but I do think when the first time I ever saw this, I was surprised that she was blind. It's a good misdirection, isn't it, with the sensor net that she's wearing and the fact that she's able to behave like a sighted person. But rewatching it, I've noticed that she acts like, well, I will hesitate to say she acts like a blind person because I think that
she
that's
does little
silly.
Clues though,
but she gets little clues that give away that she hardly ever blinks. She only starts to properly blink actually until the final scene in the transporter room, where she's a lot more natural and she's actually playing it like she can see them.
Yeah.
Whereas there is this sort of slight kind of, she's got this kind of vacant off in the distance looks, which I think a lot of sighted people use when they're playing blind people.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's how blind.
But I think it also as well is it just adds to her sense of aloofness, doesn't it, really?
Yes.
The fact she's cold. She's seen as cold.
Yeah.
But this is...
In fact, she can't see.
Yeah. But it's great. There's a brilliant bit when, obviously, McCoy tells the guys... that she's blind, and then Spock starts pokes her in the
Don't do that. That's really rude. You can't do that.
I'm a scientist. I'm allowed.
I do think. I mean, Shatner. I think Shatner's fairly decent in this. I think that they do some weird things with his character, but I mean, and he doesn't have a lot to do in this episode.
No.
But I do like his reaction when he goes, because he hits on Miranda as well. He tries to hit on her, but he's doing it, you know, for proper reasons. He's doing it for king and country this time, or at least that's what he's trying to convince himself. But I have struggled with Kirk the Lothario because in early season Kirk, early Star Trek, Kirk is not a Lothario. He's, if anything, a bit of a geek.
Yeah.
And it's only because the network wanted him to score more that he's become that. And I don't think it fits well with him. I mean, I think there are some episodes in which it works okay, and there are some episodes where it really doesn't work okay.
Yeah.
I think that this one just, you know, just doesn't seem right. And
he piles it on, doesn't it?
He's not actually a very good Lothario, Kirk. No. I don't think. He's not a very good charmer. And Miranda just eats him alive, really. Just he just doesn't. She just is not in. She just sees what's happening. Let's just sorry, speak briefly to that kind of the dichotomy, the ugliness inside. Do you think Miranda is being treated fairly as a character by having all this jealousy inside her? I mean, is this a problematic element?
Yeah, I didn't like it, actually, to be honest. I thought that it was, you know, but then again, you know, it served the story.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel that it actually worked very well with my understanding of what people are like, you know. But, you know, it's a case of it served the story. I just didn't like the idea about the only woman there being sort of held up as being either someone who spurns men or has lots of jealousy or has, lots of issues with being not the normal woman that she's supposed to be.
Yeah, the idea that she's not comfortable in her own skin because of a man.
And
she's jealous of Spock because she's concerned that Spock's got a better relationship with Kos, and she's in love with Kos. Presumably, this is all that she's in love with.
At least they give that a little bit of backstory. The fact that Spock was offered the job first, she was second choice, wasn't she?
Yeah, so that's right. So there's some justification for her. But I mean, I think that it is an unfortunate way of portraying what is a very strong character. But
there is a lot of insanity going around in this episode. So, and there is this.
That's the thing. I did actually think that. I thought maybe she's a bit insane.
Yeah. And I think there is a bit of like insane leakage. But there's a TNG episode of Sarek when. Trying to keep hold of his control his emotions, things start breaking out around him.
Yeah,
and you could almost see this very similar sort of thing happening here. The key scene I think that is really interesting is when Marvik's caught and he's being held down, and what he's saying is like, "I can't fall asleep. They come at you in the dreams."
Yeah,
and almost as if there is a sort of like telepathic thing going on where. It could be just the ramblings of a madman, or it could be a clue as to what's actually driven him and the others to acting slightly out of character, and obviously what might be happening to Jones herself.
Yeah.
The fact that she might be being driven by something that she's not in control of.
Yeah. Yes.
I think that's a very good hypothesis. I just want to throw something in here, which is just going to take us off slightly, but... you tweeted this year that tweeted recently about the 25 years of Babylon 5. Something it reminded me was in one of the major parts of Babylon 5, the ambassador Kos, who is an energy entity inside a exoskeleton, which is a box.
Yes,
is also accompanied by a telepath.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if they sort of nicked that idea.
Yeah, well, totally.
I've been rewatching Babylon 5 on Pick, and I've been really enjoying it. But my God, I'm surprised that they didn't sue. That show is Star Trek. There are so many Star Trek tropes in that, and not to mention actors and scriptwriters in that show.
Yeah.
And I know that they've altered. Fundamentally, but you know, that show is Star Trek right down at its core.
Yeah, yeah.
The kind of stories that it tells,
it so
and that's why it's so good. Yeah, but in fairness, what it did was it did stuff that back then it did stuff that I think a lot of Star Trek fans wanted Star Trek to do, but couldn't or wouldn't.
And it did actually happen.
I think eventually they did.
In DS9,
I think actually Orville serves a similar purpose, although it's a very different show. Okay, so let's talk about Medusa, and let's talk about Carlos, and let's talk about Spock.
Mm.
Okay, so let's talk about that scene. I love that scene on the bridge when Spock melds with because Larry's by now he's taken us out to the galactic beyond the galactic barrier, which we see for the third time now.
Yes,
third time.
When have we
gone before? By Another Name and this one.
Yeah,
yeah, and not again.
Yeah, and this time. I mean, again, with the first time we saw it, I mean, the barrier affected human beings, but this
telepathic affected most, wasn't it?
People with
high HP rating.
Of course it did. How foolish to have forgotten something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they do to you, see.
But they come at you in your dreams. And they didn't. It's a shame they didn't It might.
Well, that's yeah, the most complicated matter in the universe.
And they maybe probably only use it that's why because they just use that.
Maybe that moment, but it does take a few days for that to kick in, doesn't it? Mm, she might have gone back and she might have done a Dana and like looking at in the mirror.
It's a potential sequel for you right there, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Is the whether
that's,
or not.
That's our sequel
guys,
of the week.
Guys, yeah, you're unsheathing your head cannons again.
Yeah. No. Sequel of the week is a thing we're doing with fiction. Possible legacy. Potential legacy. Potential fan fiction. Like Return to Tomorrow last week that we covered in the last episode, this is another opportunity for Leonard Nimoy to emote,
yes,
and to come out of there.
And a similar sort of thing again with its
and
consciousness.
He's all smart, but I mean, unlike Henock, his smiles aren't sinister. His smiles are genuine, and it's very clear that this man is this Colossus is a wonderful.
Yeah,
he has a wonderful speech.
You like to go for a pint with him.
The speech is great, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, I enjoy the speech about how the difference between his life and also because then it allows us to imagine true alien life.
Mm. How compact your bodies are! And what a variety of senses you have. This thing you call language, though, most remarkable. You depend on it for so very much. But is any one of you really its master? But most of all, the aloneness. You are so alone. You live out your lives in this shell of flesh, self-contained, separate. Lonely you are. Terribly lonely.
Ambassador. You must dissolve the link.
So soon.
And he does it with such, he's beautifully directed as well, as a lovely close-up, and it's just, there's life so much great sincerity in his expressions and in there. And it's quite moving. And I also enjoy the little bit of byplay that he has with Kirk and then McCoy and then Uhura and then Miranda. And even when, you know, he's working that kind of just, he's leaning back in his chair after he's performed this move and he's accepting Chekhov's appreciation with sincere gratitude and, you know, of someone who, you know, of someone who's been praised very highly. And there's just that incomplete sincerity in that scene that I really, really like. And of course it's very short, but it works really, really well.
Nimoy's acting chops are shown again, and they're very good and different from the, you know, the line.
And I do like the way that they handle the whole thing of him going back there without the visor, and I think it works really well. I think it just is totally sort of, you just think, but the visor, and no matter when you're so
going, whoops, because about that one.
This episode is one. I mean, what you were saying earlier about the fact that was it a surprise, and it was only about 10 minutes in that I remembered that she was blind.
Oh, really?
So long since I'd seen it. But I was so familiar with the episode that this has got a lot of familiarity with me, rather than Return to Tomorrow, which was, I was almost seeing with new eyes, really. But this one wasn't, because it has so many things that are quite memorable in it. But that whole scene at the end, and I remember that quite clearly coming up, and I thought, yeah, this is exactly how I remembered it.
So, no, they do work it really well, actually. Yeah. I mean, they don't cut to the visor until it's too late, until it's gone. And then when Sulu picks it, I'm like, whoa. And I mean, it's very clever, because the whole idea that presumably, I mean, it was never established, but we are assuming the accusation is that Dr. Jones made Spock forget about the visor, and made everybody forget about the visor, because that is the extent of her telepathy. But that wasn't actually established. She didn't acknowledge that.
I didn't actually see that myself.
No. You think you forgot it?
No, I think because it wasn't Spock, it was Kalish. He didn't think about it.
Yeah,
it's Kalish.
My visor. He went. Yeah.
That's what I saw.
I mean,
I've actually always just kind of believe. Yeah. Because Kirk accuses her.
Yeah, later on.
Because Kirk has to go in there and mansplain to her.
Yeah.
Which is a bit shit.
It's horrible, actually.
And he gives her a right old Kirk-splaining.
He throws her against the walls. Right?
Yeah, that's a bit shit. Well, that's a bit. It's a bit 1960. Yeah, it's a bit 2017. and 1967. we're laughing, but it's not funny. Okay, I buy that. So yeah. He just forgets.
Well, because he's a different character, and you know,
my perception is
so relaxed about it. That's it. And you like, you know, he's not.
But he oozes that, you know, that sense of, you know, all the crew are all relaxed around him. They'll all be, you know, just patting his back and going, yeah.
Which is what makes it so good when they see realize, oh my god,
oh no.
In fact, I would actually say that they would prefer to actually have him back than Spock and keep him there. This is our new crewman,
It's interesting that they never actually pursued that, because again, we talked about alien transference in the last episode, Return to Morag. I mean, and we also talked for a little while about the Trills, didn't we?
Yeah, did, yeah.
And shared consciousness. This is actually a little bit more like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The idea of a Medusan inhabiting another body and sharing their consciousness, you know, for the purposes.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
While like they had, in fact, they had Larry trying to work on the mechanics of trying to get the Medusans to work the ship better so that they could navigate the stars better. What they've gone down a road of is actually, well, what about telepathic contact and effectively, you know, spending some time in another person's body with them while they do their work and then going back in your box
afterwards. Well, you have that lovely little line with McCoy when Spock has started, you know, he's talking to Uhura, and he's like going on about where he mentioned the Byron thing, and it's like, that's not Spock, and then it turns around straight away to Spock speaking, actually, I'm that's Spock.
That's a good impression of D. Kelly. I've got what you got going on there. Yeah. Going on there.
Okay, it's the only one I can do.
Fine. So, I mean, let's just talk about the final sequence, I think, then, and any themes or anything that you think we haven't sort of like addressed. But the significance of that final scene is that everyone, there's an extremely emotional episode, I think it's fair to say, and everybody gets together and everyone is, apart from Larry, of course, poor Larry.
Life is cheap.
Yeah. Life is cheap when you're Larry. Everyone is happy, and there's been some kind of contentment. And there's where the infinite diversity and infinite combination things comes out. Really, actually, pivotal scene in Star Trek, and it's very, very nice and warming, and it all ends up quite nicely. The inner geek in me wants to go, well, why did Spock put the visor down but Kirk didn't have a visor when we were still in the transport when they were beaming out? Well, yeah. But I thought, no, let's not.
I think you just looked in because they look cool.
I think that's what I thought. I was watching that thinking,
we should very briefly just say the visor is cool.
It is cool.
And there's lots of really cool pictures of Spock and that visor.
Yeah, but it does sit up a bit high on Spock, actually. But the ear bits don't actually touch his ear.
I think that's why the way he wants to wear it. That's the way the cool kids wear it.
Yeah, because Miranda wears it properly, but he wears it a little bit higher up.
What do you think is properly?
It's what the cool kids like.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. If you want to wear it like a girl, then
just stow your visor.
Which is cool, by the way.
Stow your visor chauvinism over there. Don't mind, please. There's no room for it in this podcast. Okay, so yeah, any final thoughts on this episode? This discussion has whizzed by, but I think it's been half an hour or so.
It's cracking.
It is cracking.
It is cracking. It's very different.
It is different.
But it is very Trek.
And why is it cracking? It's cracking. It's psychological horror.
Very
emotional adult themes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Different directing. Different ways. Explores different ways of good photography, telling the story.
Yeah, good framing.
It questions a lot. It makes you question a lot of things.
Even after the big confrontation where Miranda cures Spock, and Spock arrives at sickbay, then out comes Kirk and looks down the corridor, and then they have that high shot up from the ceiling, glowing down along there. And when he's looking around, trying to see where she is. I mean, just little stuff like that just really work very well. And actually, for an episode that ties itself up in a bow, as they all have to, this one actually was a nice little thing. It was a proper little self-contained story.
I think you find a lot with a lot of episodes is that where they have the act, the break in acts, there is something where that they try to push something in the story to make it a little bit more interesting, or to say, right, okay, we've got a bit of a boring bit here, so we'll have a bit of action or something like that. This doesn't need it because there are pivot points in all along in this episode.
Yes, I couldn't actually tell you where those moments are actually because it runs so nicely.
Yeah.
I mean, anything you don't like about it? Is it too thin or not too thin?
Not at all.
I mean, again, Miranda is a problematic character of her time. It's
the way she's treated sometimes. There is one sequence which I really got on my nose, was actually that bit where you can't drive the ship because you're a woman. You can't park that car.
Right, okay. You know, that was because she doesn't know how to fly a ship.
You can't do it because you're blind, wasn't it?
Well, there is that.
That's what it was.
Yeah, I know, but it started off.
Right, but
it starts off like, that's the way it sort of makes out, you know.
Okay.
But you can't drive it because you're blind. It's a bloody starship. It's all black outside.
I think that's a good point. I personally can forgive that. Because she was blind. Yeah. And also I think that it's difficult because obviously you're trying to serve the story, but yeah. I mean,
her sense of mesh is obviously a precursor to Geordie's visor.
I know. I was thinking, that's quite cool. I mean, the way that they've done that, there obviously are various different ways of overcoming these. Well, I suppose, there's a whole conversation that you could have about disability in Star Trek and what disability actually is. And whether or not disability is disability, or it's just simply society unable to cope with certain types of people.
Yeah.
And the Geordie kind of is a symbolic of that conversation, and I guess Miranda is as well, of people who are able to live in a society because society is able to accommodate them.
Also,
albeit through technology.
Also, the ambassador is as well. Completely different from everyone else. So he obviously has to have a different environment.
Not even invited to the dinner. Even in the comfort of his box.
He's an ambassador. He should have been invited.
Yeah. I mean, he would have brought some Ferrero Rocher, wouldn't he?
Exactly. Well, I mean, he wouldn't have done because it wasn't his reception.
Oh,
had it been the ambassador's reception,
then of course
it would have been an entirely different matter.
Yeah.
I reckon we can leave it there.
Oh, you forgot about Scotty, though. Scotty had quite a good bit in here. He was a bit nerdy because he wanted to show off his engines, but as he does. But you also saw him in his dress uniform.
Yeah,
which
was
pretty good.
You just want to mention his kilt, don't you?
His kilt,
yeah.
You know, but he did. I mean, he had the fish fight as well, actually, and he did get thrown up against the bulkhead a couple of times.
Yeah, that's very true. And this is all true.
And this is the last appearance of Lieutenant Leslie.
Is it really?
Yeah. The actor got injured when Spock goes mad. And actually, where his bit in it has actually been cut out because he actually injured his back.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm. And when he fell back, I think.
Well, that guy's still knocking around and appears in the convention circuit.
Ah.
I can't remember his name, sadly. But good stuff. All right, okay. So the passing of the legend that is, that guy.
That guy.
Mr. Leslie, who fulfilled whatever role was required. That must have been a sweet gig.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, that's the end of it. So thank you very much indeed for listening. From myself, Terry DeFellin, and Graham Sibley, and Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
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 I understand, Mr. Spock. The glory of creation is in its infinite diversity.
And the ways our differences combine to create meaning and beauty.
Long life, Spock.
Live long and prosper, Miranda.